Hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of Media Voices, the media focused podcast that brings you all the news and the views from around the media world. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
I'm Peter Houston.
So in case you've missed it, this week we've released our annual Media Moments 2019 report in association with What's New in Publishing, sponsored by Sovereign. So if you go to whatsnewinpublishing.com, you can read that. It's got, we've each written sections about M&A, platforms, reader revenue, pretty much all the big media moments of 2019 and what they mean for 2020. So big report, go and download it from What's New in Publishing.
This week I spoke to Nick Newman, who's a digital media strategist for the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism. They've just published a report into the future of news podcasting, looking at the state of the medium across five different countries. They found that while only 6% of podcasts are classified as news, those podcasts get over a fifth of all listens. So there's some great insights and some hope for the future of journalism in there, so do stay tuned. Ahead of that, as ever, we are beginning with our news roundup. And Esther, you should probably take this first story because you've been all over this one.
Okay, so Apple News have launched a daily email newsletter. So they're calling this daily newsletter Good Morning. It's basically going to be a curated newsletter of the best stories from the most trusted sources. So it's quite an interesting move because Apple News itself has been quite a success of publishers. They're getting really good page views. Generally, the numbers for the number of people that use the product are sky high. But obviously, Apple News launched Apple News Plus in March this year, and it's pretty much tanked. Mm. They signed up 200,000 people to the initial free trial, and yeah, apparently the conversion has been like virtually nothing in addition to that, to the actual paid product. So there's a little bit of a timing thing here that the first Good Morning email that went out, it had content from, you know, Washington Post, Reuters, LA Times and that lot. But it also had a section about Apple News Plus articles. So it's almost like this is now going to be a bit of a marketing ploy for the Plus product.
Mm.
I mean, there's a lot of really difficult things with Plus. Like, people have apparently just been really confused about what it is, why there are like magazines in there, because the news product itself was just like RSS feeds from publishers of articles, and now you can get like magazines, you can get like newspapers, you can get PDF stuff in there, and it's just, people have just been really confused about it.
I think Apple's really confused about it.
Yeah, they knew they had to have something in the market, but you said, you know, the design of Apple News, Peter, has been emulated, and it's been emulated quite widely, but not necessarily. They haven't necessarily understood the kind of the ecosystem as well.
I think there's echoes of the newsstand issues that they had in this, that they didn't really quite understand what it was they were trying to do.
Definitely.
They've kind of mashed everything together, and it's like, it's that whole content is content thing. Brexit is Brexit, or I don't know. It's just, it doesn't quite sit right.
All right.
I think we discussed this when Apple News Plus first launched, that it's not, writing is not writing, and that you can't just have an app with writing in it. Like, you can't mix new, like, the experience when you go to read news articles and the experience when you go to read a magazine, the intent is very, very different, and to chuck them all in one content app is just mind-bogglingly, like, what is going on?
Also now, aren't they talking about, I saw something about them actually bundling everything in one subscription.
Yeah.
So music and content like this and film or TV or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, that whole space is so confusing. People are basically saying, you know, maybe that is the only way to subsidize news content, but at the same time, isn't this not a regression to kind of the mega bundle idea?
Yeah, so this is actually discussed a little bit in Media Moments 2019. Well, it is a big thing, and if Apple won't be the only ones to make moves to do this. So they were looking at bundling News Plus.
Also, if I was working for Apple Music, I'd be kind of pissed off because everyone else has got a plus after it and they don't.
Oh, they will.
What's that about?
The other issue with that is that publishers are receiving, you know, they're scrapping over 50% of that $9.99 a month. And if the bundle is like, I don't know, $19.99 a month or something, it's even less money for them to basically get and fight over and everything else, especially once you take into account all the music.
All right, so riddle me this then. If this newsletter then is in service of promoting the content that's found on Apple News Plus.
It is.
Okay, so because it's in service of promoting the content found on Apple News Plus, who are going to be the big winners, if any, from this new initiative?
Big publishers. Because it's going to be, well, Esther read the list at the beginning. It's going to be Reuters and the Washington Post and the New York Times and the LA Times and blah, 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 blah. And those guys are going to get preference. They're going to get priority. And little guys are going to get lost.
Mm.
Unless they bring some level of personalisation to it.
Yeah, I did wonder about this. I did have a look, but it doesn't... So there's some interesting things about the way the newsletter is structured, which, you know, I'm not an Apple user. I haven't received it, but I've read up a bit. And it doesn't look like they're personalised. It's at the moment, it's just, you just get like a daily bulletin, which is interesting because the app is very personalised now. But also, it'll be curated by humans. Yay, human curation is a plus point. but Apple are also writing the summaries for these articles. The headlines are from the publishers, but essentially the summaries, the snippets, are being written by Apple's editorial team.
Oh my God, doesn't that make Apple a publisher?
Yes.
Doesn't that mean they have to take some responsibility for the content on their platform?
No, it doesn't mean that they are now a publisher. They have been a publisher for a while. But yeah, this is just kind of another nail in the coffin to the argument that they're just a carrier.
This is another toe over the line from being like an aggregator of publishers' content to making that editorial decision as to how you're going to present a publisher's story. And if I don't know, it's a really awkward line, because if my story appears there and they've rewritten my summary, I'd be like, dudes, what's going on?
Yeah, but at the same time, they're not stepping on the toes of publishers who will then say, well, you owe us money for this. And it would be funny. It would just be funny if Apple, you know, took that summary and completely rewrote it to basically be like, nah, they're talking shit.
That would be cool.
Yeah. That's when you start editorializing.
There are a couple of other things in play with this. Firstly, is that there hasn't actually been any like opt-in or marketing for this. So the initial the initial email base has basically gone out to everybody who signed up for the app and signed into it, which is millions of emails. So in terms of traffic, that's going to be great.
This is like putting U2 on people's iTunes all over again.
I was going to say that. It's like that insidious moment when Bono appeared on everyone's computer.
But actually, Simon Owens pointed out this afternoon that actually, because if they're going straight to inboxes, this is going to target a lot of desktop users.
Mm.
And mobile users have kind of been notoriously difficult to monetize, even on Apple's products. So if they're going straight to the desktop and they're pushing the desktop version of News, and therefore News Plus, where it is easier to convert people, you know, people are more willing to get their credit card out if they're on their desktop. It's going to be a bit of a quick win for Apple and some of those publishers.
So it's been a busy week of little stories. So effectively, the rest of the news roundup is going to be news in brief. So Esther, do you want to begin with actually some quite huge news?
I will, but I would also just say that all the news I put in the news in brief was good news, and you've ruined it at the bottom. So starting off with lots of cheery news. Actually, no, this isn't particularly cheery. This is slightly worrying. Google's founders, who I actually didn't realise were still involved, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, are stepping down. Google's CEO Sundar Pichai is assuming the role of both Google and Alphabet CEO. But I did love their joint letter, which basically said, we believe it's time to assume the role of proud parents, offering advice and love, but not daily nagging.
So in America,
the US states.
The recently formed advertising group Privacy for America has released guidelines to help shape future legislation around data collection in the hope of influencing national regulations. I saw a thing on this where they were saying that the worry was that every state was going to end up with its own regulations.
Yeah, do you not know where you read that?
Was that last week?
No, you read that in the Media Moments 2019 report.
Ah, have we done a report on that?
Yes, Peter.
Well, I just showed you that I read it. Anyway, so I read in the Media Moments report that the worry is all the US states are going to end up with a separate privacy rules. So I guess this is about fixing that.
Hooray.
Yeah, it is. It is pretty much so. California has obviously taken with its Privacy Act, it's taken a very, very hard line. Which just means it's making it really difficult for a lot of US companies. So there are a lot of states that are like, well, we want to introduce regulations, but not like that harsh. And any state regulation would still have to be enforced at like a state level. So it's even more complicated than Europe's.
Great. And moving on to the start of effectively a Telegraph news gauntlet. In the UK, the Telegraph has launched a digital recipe channel called Cookbook.
Nice naming.
Yeah. Perhaps with the aim of replicating some of the success that the NYT has seen with its cooking subscription, you know, which they've attributed a lot of their subscription success to their crossword and cooking app, and their new parenting one to a sort of slight extent. So, yeah, I think Telegraph diversifying outside of news, something they're increasingly going to do.
Yeah, the cookbook is currently free, but there's no other possible reason you would get into that unless you were looking at monetizing it later down the line.
Oh, they're absolutely going to monetize it, yeah. Whether that's through e-commerce or whether they do spin it off into its own paid-for thing. Absolutely.
Telegraph crockpot.
Whoa.
Talking of the Telegraph has also launched The Briefing, which is like a 2-minute podcast show updated for the morning and evening commute. Apparently this started as a WhatsApp thing, which is quite interesting.
Yeah, they put it out initially as kind of a very short bulletin on WhatsApp, and then I suppose they're broadening it out.
Well, you can't send mass stuff on WhatsApp anymore. They're clamping down on that from December. So
now it's just like a 2-minute podcast?
Yeah. In the interview that we've got coming up in a bit with Nick Newman, I ask whether it's effectively an inevitability that we're going to see every newspaper launch a daily bulletin or two in audio format. And broadly, he thinks we're going to see many more of them launch it. And, you know, we go into why it's kind of beneficial for the newspapers. Interesting that the Telegraph's doing it, considering their demographic is older than the average podcast audience member.
But they've had a very busy week. Because as well as the cookbook and the briefing, they've got more paying subscribers online than they have in print for the first time in 164 years. They now got 420,000 subscribers. I guess that's digital subscribers. And they're growing at the fastest rate ever. Well done, The Telegraph.
And podcast listeners on Spotify have grown more than 50% since the start of the year. That one is, I mean, that stat on its own is notable, but it's not necessarily the big issue here because podcasts are kind of relatively recent addition to Spotify's library after, you know, some investment towards the end of last year. The big thing here is that there's been a 39% increase in podcast hours consumed by listeners since the last quarter, suggesting that the push that they've been doing is enormous.
I think it's just discoverability, isn't it? You know, if you've got a big tab saying podcasts on Spotify, you're a lot more likely to listen to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, they've got recommendations now as well. They never had that before. Did everyone get their 2019 moments thing done? Not our report. We've got a report out called Media Moments. This was Spotify's moment.
And Barstool Sports, which debuted their Barstool Gold programme in January, has topped more than 30,000 paying subscribers to it. So again, more good subscription stories.
Yeah, I'm interested in this, particularly in light of The Athletic, just because it seems like people who are doing premium sports subscriptions are actually doing especially well. I don't know whether there is something that, you know, whether that needs to be added to the chart of what people are willing to pay for separately than news, but...
The timeline of this is actually quite interesting because 30,000 in a year is great, but they actually got a third of that during the first 3 days of their January debut.
There's also a thing with sports, I think, that I can't remember who it was. I think it was actually someone from The Athletic I was talking to that was saying that there's so much sports out there that people are actually looking for something different. They're looking for a way to get specialised sports coverage or to be able to focus in on their teams, and that's what people are paying for. So if you can kind of create a little niche for people or allow people to create their own niche, then that's when you can sell them a subscription. Anyway, National World, set up by newspaper entrepreneur David Montgomery, is in talks to buy JPI Media. Hooray!
So Report for America, which is a programme launched in 2018 to place journalists in newsrooms across the US, has announced it's going to field 250 emerging journalists in 164 news organisations next year, which is the single biggest hiring wave of journalists at a local level in the States, which is just fantastic news.
More good news!
So do you remember last week we were talking about the Lib Dems effectively aping the style of a local paper for a political ad?
Oh, yeah.
And we just genuinely couldn't understand why they'd done it. We couldn't understand why anybody would get behind this.
Well, I could.
Well, yeah, because you said it would give them some legitimacy.
No, not legitimacy. It would just get them some attention.
Oh, that's right. Well, everybody broadly came out and pilloried it and said that was a very, very bad idea, slap on the wrist. But it turns out that the Conservative Party had also done it in Coventry the same week, and they've been wisely keeping quiet about it until it got flagged up today.
I think News UK's CEO also actually put quite a public call out for political parties to end this practice.
He did, yeah. But it's because he's worried about the Sun losing the monopoly on government propaganda.
Hey! It's not really a monopoly, is it?
No, it's not.
To be fair, it's shared between four or five major titles.
So this week I spoke to Nick Newman, who is a digital media strategist. They have just published a report into the future of news podcasting. We're a news podcast, you're listening to a news podcast, so it seemed pertinent. They're looking at the state of the medium across five different countries. So I asked him about the extent to which young people are responsible for the growth in news podcasting, whether we've already hit a news podcast plateau, and whether news publishers need to be concerned about podcast revenue cannibalizing their other revenue streams. But I began by asking him what spurred the team to do a news podcast report in the first place.
I think it is probably the hottest topic right now in media. I mean, when I go to conferences, the first question is almost always about podcasting. Secondly, I love audio. I started off in radio, actually. And the reason I got into media was because I love listening to radio and I wanted to be part of it. So I think I've always been interested in audio. And, you know, I'm just really excited to see digital audio take off. And I genuinely think we're at the sort of start of a new golden age of audio in many, many different forms as radio itself starts to get disrupted, or the way we've traditionally thought about radio starts to get disrupted.
And it's interesting, actually, that the report demonstrates there was this kind of explosion in the number of news podcasts around 2015. So why is that, and how do you think that's going to play out, you know, at the start of this new golden age, as you said?
Yeah, I mean, I think sort of 2014, 2015 is when people sort of think about it. I actually helped to start the BBC's podcasts something like 15 years ago. And, you know, that was quite a thing. We put them online and they did incredibly well. And then everything sort of plateaued until about 2014. And I think what happened there was partly Apple put the podcast app as default on iPhones. So that gave it a huge boost, of course. And then you had sort of Serial, which, you know, really sparked a chord and showed people that, you know, it didn't have to be radio programs. You could create these episodic audio events that you had to come back for because you wanted to know what happened next. And that sort of just sparked a lot more interest, this sort of second wave, if you like.
Yeah, and you actually cite a couple of examples in the report. You know, you talk about Dr. Death, which I know that me and my girlfriend were both hooked on all the way through. What is it about the kind of the episodic format then that you think appeals to kind of the sensibilities of people who are producing traditionally news content?
Yeah, I mean, I think from a listener point of view, it's the same as a Netflix drama, isn't it? You know, it's essentially high production values. It's about suspense. It's about character, plot. All of these things are sort of built into audio. And, you know, apart from radio dramas, we didn't really have that in radio. So I think that's opening up a lot of new sort of creative possibilities. But I think audiences love that as well because it's entertaining. It's fun. It's not, you know, you're not listening to podcasts as a chore. These things are genuinely sort of stimulating and you just can't wait for more.
Mm-hmm. I think what really stuck out for me early on in the report is the disparity between the number of news podcasts and the amount of listenership that the news genre actually gets. Was it 6% of podcasts are news, but they make up more than a fifth of listenership?
It's something like that, yeah. So that's why we were really quite interested in the sort of comparing the supply and the consumption side. So 6% of all of the Apple directory, so that's 770,000 podcasts or whatever, are news. So a relatively small number of news podcasts, but definitely punching above their weight. So 21% of the top episodes in the Apple charts are categorized as news. I think in the UK it's a little bit lower, it's about 16%, and a country like France is about a third. And I think that sort of just really speaks to the fact that news is important generally. People use a lot of news elsewhere, but typically, you know, historically in podcasts, news hasn't really been part of that picture. So maybe, you know, Serial kind of things, but news that really is new, and that dates back to sort of the Daily and these the sort of rival of these daily news podcasts.
So what then about the kind of the daily news podcast do you think is responsible for those, you know, that disparity between news podcast numbers and actual listener numbers? Is it the fact that they do get people back in regularly, that they, you know, they associate with a brand? I'm sure there's any number of theories, but why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think it's it's the stickiness, it's the habit building. Again, I think it's also the way in which particularly the deep dive daily podcasts are constructed. So it's not just about telling you the news. It's about, you know, really helping you understand a topic, but it's also plot driven. You know, people talk about narrative storytelling. So when you listen to one of these things, you know, it's got the sort of hook at the beginning. It often starts with a character, with a person. It brings that person to life. It's got a sort of a little bit of a mystery at the beginning, which then unfolds as the thing goes on. So I think all of those things, and yeah, they are incredibly sticky. I mean, in the publishers we talk to, it's something like sort of the completion rate somewhere between 60 and 90%. The Guardian was saying 80% for their Today in Focus podcast, for example. People are typically, according to the publishers, listening to 2 or 3 or sometimes 4 on average of the 5 podcasts that there are during the week. So definitely habit forming, definitely sticky, and entertaining, which I think is the key.
I've been a big podcast booster, you know, like yourself, for the last couple of years, and those stats take me by surprise. I didn't think that there would be anywhere near that number of people who are so invested day after day after day.
Yeah, and I suppose the key question is, are they going to continue to be? So is it, you know, just this small section of people who are very interested in news? And then once you've got all of those people, and once the sort of supply of them is increasing as it is sort of every week, you know, is that growth still going to continue? And I think that's the big question for the daily news podcast. But I think in audio generally, there's huge opportunity.
And you mentioned kind of this deep dive podcast before. I think you categorize news podcasts into 3 different categories?
Yeah, so we were just looking at 5 countries, so UK, US, France, Sweden, Australia. And in those, we basically went through and looked at sort of native podcasts. So this is not sort of catch-up radio, but this is native, it's made for the medium. And then we identified 60 of these, and we categorized them into sort of short form, sort of 1 to 6 minutes. This is like the thing you might ask your Alexa speaker, give me the news, and it gives you 1, 2, 3 minutes maybe. Then in the middle, you've got sort of shorter daily news updates. So things like FT Business Briefing, you've got Up First, which is NPR's very successful podcast in the US that has around 1 million listeners, and that sort of maybe a number of different subjects. And then you've got things like The Daily, which is really doing one subject in depth, or Today in Focus actually does 2 subjects, but it does 1 in depth and then a short one. And that seems to be slightly the more dominant of the 3 types, and certainly one of the most successful in the UK and the US.
So the success of The Daily, I remember seeing Mark Thompson talk about this at the World News Media Congress, and how they initially kind of, they promised their sponsor, their initial sponsor for it, listener numbers, which they surpassed by about 5 times or something. They blew past their initial targets. So, I mean, do you think that having seen The Daily, there's been an element of follow the leader in terms of what other news publishers are doing with that? Or have we seen a lot of experimentation in and around kind of the news podcast form and the format and what that actually sounds like?
Yes, there's definitely a certain amount of copying going on, or let's call it inspiration. So I talked to lots of publishers who just started a daily news podcast. So, you know, for example, Le Parisien in France, Les Echos, Today in Focus, you know, they all basically said they were inspired by The Daily, or a lot of those ones that are doing the deep dive. And they referenced it directly. They said they'd listened to it, and they've maybe slightly adapted the format. But they've looked at that success and said, can we, you know, there's nothing like this in our country, for example, so could we get that first mover advantage by just learning what the New York Times has already learned, that people are looking for that kind of depth. And if you do it in a particular way with narrative storytelling techniques, you use music really well to create mood, then that is something that we think can travel internationally. And certainly in the ones that have launched, they do seem to be striking a chord pretty much everywhere. So I think it's definitely a good format. Other people are actually specifically saying we don't want to do what the New York Times is doing because, you know, the New York Times has sort of defined the market in the US. So the Washington Post, you know, said specifically we're not going to do one topic, we're going to do three topics. Mm. And we're going to aim it at the evening, not the morning, because partly it speaks to our brand and the fact we cover lots of different stories and that's what we're known for. And similarly, you know, the Economist said, well, we're gonna be global and we want to show the range and diversity of everything that we've got in the publication. So again, they went for a format that had more than one story. So there are definitely people thinking differently, but a lot of people are also trying to do what the New York Times did, but just in a different country.
Yeah, so you said there that you've seen a lot of people who were saying that they definitely didn't want to be doing what the NYC was doing. They wanted to be doing their own sort of thing. So I'm thinking in terms of what kind of Reach are doing with Laudable and where The Guardian's sort of positioning its own audio as kind of a core tenet of its membership proposition. So what's your sense then of how important podcasting is going to be to publishers over the next couple of years? Is it going to increase? Is it still going to be one of those things that publishers take a punt on, or is it going to be integral?
I think it's going to be integral. I think if you think about the sort of underlying drivers of this, the consumer drivers of it, it's obviously driven by younger people, and publishers are really looking and finding it hard to reach and engage younger audiences. They're also looking for revenue opportunities, and we've seen advertisers starting, certainly in the US and the UK, really getting stuck into podcasting and putting a lot more of their budgets into podcasting. And the whole industry is thinking about how do we create loyalty and how do we create habit. And, you know, as we've already talked about, you know, audio is just a great way of doing that. The Daily and New York Times talk about 25 minutes a day with a medium that, it's the new front page. You know, we have 25 minutes a day with people. That kind of engagement is fantastic, and that's what other publishers are finding as well. So I think those are really the core reasons which are driving this change.
Yeah, certainly. It's almost like you mentioned young people there. It's almost this kind of antidote to this perception that young people aren't interested in news. They are. It just has to be in the right format for them. It has to match their own consumption habits.
Exactly. I mean, that's why the search for the right formats. We did a report last year on earlier this year actually on younger people and sort of their core attitudes and what and it was so. It's not news. It's about how do you create content that is interesting, engaging, fun, but is also meaningful. And to me, that's where the Daily News podcasts are hitting kind of all of those spots at once.
Yeah, certainly. And actually, I think that, you know, the stats that Spotify has released, I think it was just today, kind of does bear that out in terms of the amount of, you know, the proportion of listenership on podcasting on that platform is increasing, you know, quarter on quarter quite ridiculously. And that is a lot of young people are driving that growth.
Younger people and different demographics with Spotify as well. And we asked in the digital news report, why are you using podcasting? And younger people in particular, a lot of it was, you know, I'm bored with my playlist and so I want something else to do. So they're plugged in all the time.
And we often talk about engagement as being a kind of stepping point onto revenue, you know, almost as it should be. So where are publishers placing their chips in terms of actually generating revenue from their podcasts?
Right. So, it's primarily still advertising and sponsorship. But as you say, it's got much more sophisticated. We're starting to get programmatic. Podcasting was traditionally host reads and direct response. And now we're seeing blue chip advertisers coming in and being very interested. So there's a huge amount of change going on there. And I think as that change goes on, the real question is, is that going to annoy listeners? Mm. Is the advertising density going to get too big? Is the noise starting? Is it going to affect the creativity of the content itself? So it's interesting that within Daily News podcasts, they have sort of, I guess, neutral voices as opposed to host reads. So they tend not to have sort of jingly jangly spot ads that just are sort of dropped in because you're creating the sort of narrative story. And so they're trying to do advertising more sympathetically. And I think that's going to be hard to sustain as the thing scales. So you're starting to hear more sort of generic ads just being sort of chucked into different podcasts at different points. And if that becomes too intrusive, I think that's going to be an increasing issue.
Yeah, certainly. I noticed you mentioned that actually in one of the initial releases. And actually, anecdotally, in fact, it's not even anecdotally, it's personally. When I'm listening to a podcast and I don't get a host-read ad when it's clearly something that has been, you know, dropped in, it really does, it's interruptive in the way that, you know, people initially said that the, you know, the great strength of podcast advertising was that it would not be interruptive to that extent.
Yeah, and I mean, the ads are absolutely coming in, you know, the demand is there. And in the US and the UK, I mean, the daily news podcasts are making significant amounts of money for the really big ones. For the smaller ones, they're not yet making money in themselves and definitely not in smaller countries. But there are other benefits, you know, the loyalty benefits, the fact that you can sort of advertise other things, you can attract new audiences to your brand and then bring them into your subscription world or sell them e-commerce or, you know, all of these things are starting to happen as well. And then, of course, for others, it's about selling tickets. So there are some people who make absolutely no money from the podcast themselves, but they do these live shows. I think The Guardian a few years ago sold out the Palladium for its football podcast, for example. But I was talking to some podcasters in Kenya recently who make no money at all from advertising because there's no money in podcast advertising in Kenya. But they sell out once a month these shows in Kenya or around Africa, and that's how they make the money.
Oh God, we shouldn't have given away tickets to our 100th episode for free then.
Exactly.
That's what I'm learning there.
And you gave away the free wine, right?
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
So it cost you.
Yeah, so there's what then would be the significant impediments to podcast growth and really making them valuable for publishers? I know that you flagged up the fact that they are concerned maybe that they're actually building a value proposition for platforms rather than actually, you know, building it for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, some of the publishers I talked to were worried about. So at the moment, they either sell directly or they're selling through organizations who represent their interests, like Acast, so these sort of intermediaries. And there's quite a good balance between them. So the publishers are really selling around the context of that particular episode. But what we've seen elsewhere is that instead, ads are sold much more generically by audience. So you go to Spotify, for example, and you say, I want this particular demographic. And so it just becomes easier to buy through Spotify. And then the publisher gets, gets less of the revenue share. This is what we've seen elsewhere. So that's one of the worries. The other worry is just, you know, if you have one or two dominant platforms, then how do you get prominence? You know, you're working through an intermediary, you don't have that direct connection, you don't have the data, you know, all the same problems that we've been around many times before with platforms are starting to emerge with platforms where previously it was all about Apple and open access, and now we're going to be into a completely different world, I think.
Yeah, certainly. What do you think then about the viability of things like Luminary, which aim to be kind of that Netflix for podcasts? Is that something that you think consumers are, you know, will accept that change from open access to, you know, subscribing to a catalogue of podcasts?
I mean, most of the people I talked to were deeply sceptical about whether these would work, and they didn't think that audio was like Netflix. You know, it's not just Luminary, there's Himalaya in the US, there's Podimo's just started in Denmark and Germany, you've got Magellan and Sybil in France. So we talked to quite a few of these, and they do have these sort of big ambitions. And it's about signing up exclusive content in the first place. So you've got to have that. It's a bit like Netflix when it started. You know, there wasn't really quite enough of a proposition. So they're giving away a lot of this stuff for free right now. And they've got to persuade publishers and content owners to put their content with them, even though they're going to get less of a hit in the short term. So it's a really hard sell right now to get these things off the ground. But it's not really going to work for news because that's going to be much more commoditized and you need the reach. But I think we are definitely moving into a world where you're going to have more originals, more paid for content, more content in premium layers like Spotify, for example, with its Spotify originals. And so there will be models other than sponsorship and advertising. There will also be, you know, revenue share based on subscription income. And it's going to be interesting to see how those smaller players fit with the Spotify's or the Pandora's of this world.
Cool. So we ask all the guests on Media Voices, as you'll know, having appeared before, what was the last piece of media you really enjoyed in any format that you'd really like to recommend to our listeners?
Well, I mean, I guess as we're talking about podcasts, it better be a podcast. I've listened to a lot of podcasts recently. I'm going to go for the Spotify original about, what was it called? The Story of the Clash. The Story of the Clash. It was an eight-part series. I loved The Clash when it brought back all kinds of memories. Presented by Chuck D, who's just this former musician with Public Enemy, just brilliantly, characterfully presented. But again, you know, just great narrative stories. And I listened to them in the car in a sort of sequence. And then I actually just finished the last one this weekend. And yeah, fantastic. Highly recommended. That was done with Spotify and BBC Studios. It was one of those sort of partnership deals using a lot of the BBC's archive and then Spotify's distribution. And it also linked beautifully into playlists. So the advantage of it being in Spotify is you could then just listen to a Clash playlist as well, just the music. So yeah, great.
So Media Moments 2019 is out right now. You can download it from the What's New in Publishing website. We produced it in conjunction with What's New in Publishing, sponsored by Sovereign. Have a look, get it downloaded. We've got, how many chapters have we got in there, guys? 8 chapters on all sorts of stuff that happened this year. Get a look at it and find out what went on and what's going to come next year.
And if you want to keep up with what we do during the week, you can find us over on Twitter at Media Voices Pod, where we tweet out all the stories we've talked about and all the kind of interesting studies and analysis we find during the week as well. That's on Twitter at Media Voices Pod. And you can also see all our episodes, transcripts, all the writing we do for the industry and everything else on our website at voices.media, where you can also sign up for our newsletter. There is a lot to do on the website.
But until next week, when we're going to be back with the final episode of the year, where we're doing a look back at everything that happened and maybe doing some subtle promotion of our Media Moments 19 report, I don't know. Thank you very much for listening and goodbye.
Bye.
Get out and vote on Thursday. Maybe you can stop Brexit.
Nice.